I was talking yesterday about the problem of economic instability, the inflation depression problem. And in the 1970s, we have learned to our horror that inflation and recession can occur simultaneously. And that rather knocked in the head the simple notion deriving from the 1930s that inflation meant too much total demand, recession meant too little total demand, and that government could adjust the level of total demand if it was too much or too little to get it at just the right level, and the government could somehow eliminate these fluctuations that have been characteristic of capitalism for as long as capitalism has been around. Well, a growing number of economists, well, let me say almost all economists, perhaps all economists today, agree that if the government can stabilize the aggregate level of economic activity, you know, and keep the economy from going like this, maybe make it go like that, that if it can do it, it cannot do it either as easily as or as well as we used to think. And we economists must repent for having pridefully declared in the 1960s that if you turned the country over to us, we would eliminate the business cycle. We don't know how to do it, and I hope that I made clear some of the reasons why. Basically, this takes a tremendous amount of knowledge.
Paul, may I interrupt?
Yeah.
Paul Hayne is one that has no need to repent. He wasn't one of them.
Well, thank you, Paul. However, see, you've only known me for about 10 years. 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I can remember, in fact, Al Pitcher may remember that when I was at the University of Chicago, there was another student there in the PhD program who was doing the same kind of thing I was, working in economics and ethics. And he and I had a debate once at a brown bag luncheon where he was arguing that it was very difficult to stabilize the economy and government would be better off not doing anything. And I was arguing that that was a symptom of conservatism. He'd sold out to Ronald Reagan, you know, or whoever the equivalent was. So I repented before I met you, that's all. Repentance came early. Do you remember that, Al? Probably not. Clark Kukeman and I, yeah.
Clark, yeah. Well, he bought into Friedman early.
Yeah, well, Frank Knight. It was Frank Knight that converted me, not Friedman. But I understand Clark has gone Marxist. He hasn't? Oh, okay. All right. All right, well, I didn't say anything, didn't get around to saying anything about a totally different kind of argument explanation for our inability to prevent inflations and recessions. The argument that the economy today isn't sufficiently competitive, that we can't prevent inflation without causing unemployment, or cure unemployment without causing a lot of inflation, or even prevent the two from happening together because of big corporations and powerful labor unions and, some people add, all sorts of government policies that also inhibit competition. In other words, that in essence, the argument is that in the good old days, sometimes I wish people would define exactly when the good old days ended so that we could make some precise historical comparison, but there was a time when the economy was adequately competitive, unions weren't dominating things, and there weren't these big giant corporations dominating things, and government was behaving itself. And then the market could function to allocate resources and keep prices down. But nowadays, you see, people have power. And when you want to sell your product or your labor, you get together with your buddies or in your big corporation or something, and you hold up the public. So lots of people believe that inflation is caused by labor unions and or big corporations. No less a person than Arthur F. Burns, whom I cited yesterday, and I'd like to cite again, the current chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, has taken this position. Burns argued before he became chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which really makes him the principal honcho in charge of regulating the economy. He regulates the money supply, and that has connections with everything. Arthur Burns, like most economists, argued that inflation is caused by the creation of too much money. So when Arthur became chairman of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, you know, he had control of the spigot. And suddenly Arthur began changing his tune. He was making speeches stating that the life of a member of the Board of Governors is very difficult because unions, corporations, and the federal government, or in state government, governments at all levels, are making it impossible for him, Arthur Burns, and his colleagues to make responsible decisions. And here's why. Unions, corporations, and government, when I'm talking about government, I'm thinking about all of the ways in which governments, federal, state, and local, put restrictions on competition. The Civil Aeronautics Board, which won't let the airlines really compete. The Interstate Commerce Commission, which won't let other forms of transportation compete. All sorts of state licensing agencies and regulatory agencies whose principal effect is to make production less efficient and to keep efficient people from getting into the business. Regulations on the maximum number of bricks you can lay in a day, or that you can't open an optometrist shop unless you're 100 feet from a wine shop, and crazy. You can't believe how many such regulations there are at state and local level, usually drafted by the people who are already in the business and who want to make it expensive for other people to come into the business and compete with them. But anyway, Burns says all of this stuff put together has meant that groups have the power to jack up their prices before the demand has increased. And when they do that, something happens. If a labor union, let's say, raises its wages, when there's been no increase, a carpenter's union, there's been no increase in the demand for carpenters and wages go up, what happens? Employment declines. Maybe not right away, but people buy fewer houses, contractors will try to get by with fewer carpenters, they'll put in the house less of whatever it is that carpenters work on, and unemployment mounts among the carpenters. Similarly, suppose that the steel companies jack up their prices when there's been no increase in the demand for steel. There will be less steel purchased. And what's that going to mean? That's going to mean fewer steel workers hired, layoffs, new people coming into the labor force won't find jobs in the steel industry. And so the unemployment rate is going to go up. And when the unemployment rate goes up, then Arthur Burns is under pressure to increase the money supply. If you follow the financial pages of the newspaper, you know exactly what I'm talking about. There's tremendous pressure on the Federal Reserve. Arthur Burns is perhaps the most pilloried man in the federal government. There are people who really love to blast him. They see him as the guy who has the power to either enrich the banks by keeping the money supply down. You know, that makes they think that makes interest rates high, and supposedly that enriches the banks. He can either do that, the rascal, or he can create lots of new money and bring down the level of unemployment and distribute prosperity among the masses. That ain't the way it works, but that's the way a lot of people think it works. And the pressure on Burns is pretty severe. And though the Federal Reserve is theoretically an independent agency of the federal government, Congress can overnight make it dependent. So Burns knows that he's got to pay attention to what people are saying and what the politicians are saying. And Burns has asserted that he is in an impossible situation given the degree of market power found among all sorts of producers in the economy, that they have the power to jack up wages and prices, creating unemployment. And if he doesn't respond by increasing the money supply, he may induce Congress to destroy the Federal Reserve's autonomy. If he does respond by increasing the money supply, he causes inflation. And so what he's got is that he's forced to make a choice between unemployment and inflation, and that's an uncomfortable choice. What should we do? Burns says what we ought to do is adopt some kind of what he calls incomes policy. In other words, Burns favors some kind of government restraints on those unions and those corporations which have the power to jack up wages and prices. Now, he recognizes this is going to be very difficult, and he doesn't like it, because if you're going to put on any kinds of wages and price controls, no matter how limited, you're giving an awful lot of power to some bureaucrats. Because you can't, it's just, lots of people think that there's nothing to price and wage controls. You just freeze all prices and wages. But that's not so, because changing conditions will necessitate changes in relative prices. And if you've got controls, that means some government authority is going to have to just look at a case and say, this request for a price increase is justified. Of course, everybody's always going to be requesting price increases, but some will be justified by your own criteria. And how do you determine when they're justified and when they're not? What do? You know, you get into all sorts of crazy binds. Some corporation was being very responsible and deliberately not raising its price when it could. All of a sudden, you slap on a freeze. And now it has to pay a double penalty for its responsibility. So it comes in and says, help, help. All our competitors raised their prices the day before the freeze, and we didn't because we were being patriotic. Are you going to penalize us for that? John Kenneth Galbraith, who is a fan of wage and price controls, he worked in the Office of Price Administration during World War II. Even he has admitted that sometimes it occurred to him that the only way, really, to institute price controls is set a price of $5 for everything. let's see, what was I? I would say that price and wage controls are terribly, terribly difficult things. Burns knows that, and he wants to institute them temporarily, but what are we going to do then for the long run? Why will we be able to abandon the wage and price controls? Because, Burns says, or hopes, we are going to embark on a program of getting rid of these bits of concentrated market power. Let's restore competition to the American economy, says Arthur Burns. Well, I'm all for that. Frankly, I'm all for it. I'd like to see more competition. I'm a fan of competition. Huh?
Total social reorganization.
Well, I don't know whether it's a total social reorganization. I'm going to indicate in a moment, I think the economy is more competitive right now than many people believe. But there's a basic dilemma here. And that is, Burns points out that the government, federal, state, and local, is an active villain in the process. All right, if the government is part of the villain, who's going to solve the problem? I mean, who is there? You know, who's going to do this? Who's going to break up the monopolistic labor unions or fragment the monopolistic corporations? Or who is going to persuade the Interstate Commerce Commission to stop behaving in this reprehensible way? And I think the answer is nobody. It occurs to me, I see, what he's saying is, let's put a bell on the cat. And he's saying the government is the cat, and he's asking the government to put a bell on the cat. And the problem is if cats let themselves be belled by mice, mice would have no reason to want bells on cats.
We could appoint three Caesars with absolute power.
yeah. So the phrase incomes policy to describe this is a good phrase, because the phrase incomes policy points to the heart of the problem, and that is that we are in conflict about the distribution of income. People want more income. Most Americans want more income. Most Americans, I suspect, think that they are not receiving an income to which they are entitled. Maybe in some absolute sense they're getting what they're entitled to, but relatively not. I'll grant that my wage is pretty high, pretty comfortable, but golly, have you seen what old jerk Hotzfeltz gets? And we're always comparing ourselves with the wrong people. And consequently, we think we're entitled to more, we demand more. If we're able to get together in effective coalitions, we succeed in grabbing more, and the result is inflation or unemployment. But I don't see any way right now in which the democratic process is going to resolve this problem, because we are conflicting about the distribution of income. And incomes policy presupposes that the people in authority already know what an equitable solution to the conflict is. But we don't know. That's what we're arguing about. Now, that leads to the question of market power. And the analyses of Arthur Burns and people like him usually contain the argument that, in recent times, things have changed so that now, the economy is not adequately competitive. Corporations are less competitive. Unions are more powerful. Government is more protective of inefficiency. And I, frankly, don't see any evidence to support this. I'm talking about the more thing. It's very difficult to come up with some absolute criterion for competitiveness. It is still difficult, but somewhat easier to come up with a relative criterion. In other words, it's hard to say whether you're fat or skinny. It's easier to say whether you're fatter or skinnier. There is no body of evidence that I'm aware of that is at all convincing that either labor unions now have more power than they had in the 1930s and 1940s, or that corporations, or let's say that businesses are more monopolistic or oligopolistic now than they were in the first decade of this century. The evidence of which I'm aware runs, in fact, in the other direction. If you use to measure the power of unions, such things as, what would you use? You could use a percentage of the labor force in unions. You could use various measures of competition between the unions, measures of the effectiveness with which unions preserve their jurisdictional areas. You could use public attitudes toward unions. And by all of these measures, union power is declining. It's been declining in the last 20 years.
What about such measures as dollar worth of union, if such a thing can be measured?
Should a pension fund?
Except that I don't think the pension funds have anything to do with the power of the union in collective bargaining, which is what supposedly causes the problem.
What about its ability to buy local officials?
The pension fund can't buy local officials. The pension funds, for one thing, are not under the control of the union officials. But even then, if you're concerned about possibilities of corruption, we have had for the last 15 years a fairly tough law that makes that kind of corruption even more difficult. Now, I'm not saying that unions have lost all their power and they're weak and flabby. I just can't see any evidence that they're stronger than they were, say, in 1960. Or 1950. Where's the evidence?
Is there one thing I wonder about is, of course, government in this sense has a tremendous amount of power. And I wonder if government today isn't exercising that power in the sense that we're getting a lot more, like you say, rules and regulations on how we do things, which causes a pressure on the competitive system, which again reflects back on unions and corporations, and that they try to resist this thing, so it appears that they're more powerful in the sense that they are trying to buck this flow of garbage, I guess you'd call it, that's coming in from the government. I sense that in the corporation, because the finger of the government is in every bit of the corporational structure now, to the point where it's just absolutely nauseating to work in a big company because of that reason.
Well, okay, I don't know. Why do people think unions are gaining more power? And you're as quite as able to judge that as I can. On the assertion, however, your premise, which is that the degree of federal regulation of business and unions and other organizations is increasing apace, be no doubt about that. And I think that's something that we're going to really have to concern ourselves about. Simply because an awful lot of regulation we're getting a lot of pointless regulation. Pointless in the sense that it is incapable of accomplishing its purposes, and yet it gets on the books and it continues to be enforced. And what it does is it supports a vast army of administrators who then acquire a vested interest in the maintenance of that regulatory system. And also they become the experts then on the need for that regulatory system.
Question concerning the percentage of the labor force that is unionized. I know in my field in education, in 1950, you didn't have teachers' unions, okay? In 1970, even the National Education Association walks out on strike.
Yeah, that's
very visible, and it affects almost every household.
Yeah, that's counter to the trend, though. There has been increased unionization of professional workers, teachers, engineers, which I think is a response to some peculiar circumstances. But anyway, it hasn't been enough to affect the overall trend. And moreover, maybe we should suspect that it's the teachers who are causing the inflation. But most people don't. They think of things like the United Steelworkers, the Brotherhood of Carpenters.
If you talk about, though, there's a good example where the government steps in. Because like in a professional, like engineering, we had no engineering union, and the government comes along and says, well, you can make application, you can establish a union. And so in order to, and if somebody wants to go in there and try to organize and they can get a vote, then they become unionized. So what happens is the
the department that had no intention of being unionized at all of a sudden realizes that they'll be unionized by some outfit that they don't want. So what they do is they start their own union in there. So on this basis, that's the basis of their introduction into a union kind of an arrangement. And as the years go on, this thing gets tighter and tighter. And it's all started because the government said you gotta choose now. You know, you gotta have a union. You gotta choose which one you want.
Well, the government never says you gotta have a union. It only the NLRB will take a petition from workers and conduct an election, and then
that's
a majority.
That's right. It's an election, and then you can elect as to whether you want one or you don't want
right.
one. But the fact that it isn't spontaneous on the part of the people, basically, in other words, it is an encouragement by a government regulation. There's an encouragement to do something which might not necessarily have been done if the government hadn't stepped in and encouraged it and made it an easy way to get to it. And I'm just saying that's an example.
Yeah, well, we're still committed, and I think there's something of a paradox here in our contradiction. We're still committed, interestingly enough, to the promotion of collective bargaining. This was a policy that was adopted in the 1930s. What Congress said in its preface to the National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act, that it is the policy of the United States government to promote collective bargaining, and in the interest, as they said, of promoting industrial peace and restoring prosperity. Well, nowadays, many people are talking about the problems that collective bargaining creates, beginning to recognize that a union is really a combination and restraint of trade. But while we're worrying about the problem, we're still pursuing a policy of promoting collective bargaining. And I think we've got to get our heads a little bit straight on this issue. I'm not sure what we ought to do. I think unions, in certain circumstances, perform very important functions. I'm fairly sure that in other circumstances, unions perform indefensible functions. I'm thinking of for example, the case of public employees. You know, isn't there a contradiction here? When the law says, and I'm quoting the Wagner Act, employers organized into giant corporations have too much power over against their employees. Therefore, the government will step in and say, we give to the employees more power so that they can secure justice. All right, now, 40 years go by. Now these workers are organized against the government. There's something wrong there. Now, I'm not saying the government is, that government officials, make no mistakes, are always equitable, but is the government saying that the government is unjust and too powerful, and therefore the government will, well, it's possible, but, who defines the public interest? The San Francisco strike of this spring was a beautiful example. You followed it. Garbage workers getting what are garbage workers? 18,000. Yeah, and I'm not against garbage workers, and I think it's fine if they get 18,000. But the problem was that they had a waiting list a couple miles long, which was an indication that the wage was probably higher than needed to be paid, and the city was going bust paying these high wages. And they had a formula that advanced the wages of municipal workers, and the formula was obviously absurd because of changing circumstances. And the unions were going to close down the city if they didn't get their way. Well, we still, to some extent, some of us believe that union is a collection of workers, and workers are the good people, and the employers are the bad people, and maybe that's true. But I think we're going to have to be a little careful about that. I'm struck by the fact that in recent years, well, you mentioned engineers and teachers. And let me cite another very effective union, the American Medical Association. And I'm struck by the fact that the really successful unions are not the ones who represent the low-wage workers. That's rare when a union successfully organizes low-wage, impoverished people. Unions are most effective in the organization of highly skilled, already relatively wealthy people. George?
I was going to say, I think that's maybe one of the ways in which we could work on discovering the comparative strength of the, let's say, of the union, in the sense that power used is no longer power. It's been dissipated. Its potential use is where real power is. In other words, can a union threaten the United States and the economy? Can it bring it to a halt, like the Teamsters obviously can? Could they 20 years ago? If they can't, and today can, then maybe we have an increase in power. And the same way with the San San Francisco garbage strike, it didn't come off because they couldn't stop the city. And the teachers haven't been able to stop the cities so far. But if they can, and I think that could be measured with some degree of relevance, whether in a period of time, comparatively, more of this economy is dependent upon a corporation, you know, like the oil embargo, stopping the country with all that oil sitting out there and putting on rationing in this country and so on to get the price up real fast. That kind of thing has power, but it's powerful only if it isn't used, only if it's a threat to us.
Yeah, well, that's a good observation, but that raises the question, why is it only a power if it is a threat? Isn't the answer that if the Teamsters ever did try to close down the country, the Teamsters would be busted? I don't think the Teamsters have the power to shut the country down. I think if a truck strike ever started to come close to shutting the country down, the Teamsters Union would be seriously weakened by drastic federal action. And that's why the Teamsters, they threaten, they hope, you know, they try. It's a kind of bluffing game.
But that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's unused power that's power, not power used.
Yeah.
And, you know, if your observation is right, that you have the thinking of the country correctly, that controls would be imposed so that the economy would keep moving, then it isn't as strong.
Yeah.
But I think you're kind of going one step before you get to that point where it closed down, and that's where the power is exerted, as I see it. And what you're saying is that the political structure will do everything possible to avert having to come to that point of having to really go after the unions. And so as a result of that, they get what they want by the threat.
Yeah.
And in a sense, like you say, they could temporarily shut it down, which would react, the complete reaction would be that they put constraints on them so they couldn't do that again. But the people that want to put the restraints on could put the restraints on are very reluctant to do that. And so there's always a compromise, and the compromise is always in favor of this powerful body of people that's operating there, it seems to me.
What about New York City and its striking
movement? What about New York City? I think, since I really want to get on into something else, I'd suggest we just pray briefly about New York City. There are two other things that I've got to, I'm compelled, now, you may not interrupt me now for the next 5 to 10 minutes. I wanted to focus on the belief that the economy is dominated by giant corporations, because and I think this is untrue again. Let me indicate just throw out some things. A lot of people talk about the automobile companies, for example, and the automobile companies, giant oligopoly, they can do as they please. In fact, I've often thought that the automobile companies are one of the best examples of powerful corporations. But of course, we have to remember, first of all, that the General Motors is not a typical American firm. I've used the phrase the GM complex. I've actually heard people say, well, take a typical American firm, General Motors. It ain't. But people are continuing to say that the automobile companies have absolute power. They can produce a car that we don't want and through advertising cram it down our throats. They can set any prices they please. And people continue to say this even though the automobile companies had a terrible year when the high price of gasoline persuaded people they didn't like big cars and they couldn't sell them. And then they went into little cars like crazy, and now, as you know, they're losing their shirts on little cars because people are going back to big cars. And another thing, people talk about the power of the automobile companies to raise prices as they please. And people are not aware of the fact that automobile prices have tended since World War II to advance far less rapidly than prices of other things. Between about mid-55 to mid-65, automobile prices actually declined. They actually declined when you adjust for quality changes, while everything else was going up. It's a funny kind of, wouldn't you all agree that the food industry, maybe you wouldn't, but I insist on it, the food industry is far more competitive. Farming is competitive, food processing is competitive, food retailing is extremely competitive. And yet food prices, well, would you like the current index of food prices? It's 180, which means food has gone up 80% in price since 1967. Medical care, it's gone up 95% since 1967. New cars, 35%. Used cars, You all know used cars are more competitive than new. Gone up 68%. In fact, new cars, the increase in new car prices since 1967, I picked 1967 because, for one thing, that was the beginning of the rapid inflation, also happens to be the base year that they're currently using in the Consumer Price Index. New cars, new car prices have gone up less than any other major item in the consumer price market basket. In fact, if you were to take those products that everybody knows are produced by large monopolistic oligopolistic corporations and single them out, I predict, now of course it's going to depend on what you think is produced by large monopolistic oligopolistic corporations, but I'd be willing to bet a dollar in each case, you know, with all of you. I'd lose with a few because of your quirky choices, but I'd be willing to bet money that people made it, the selection out of the market basket that's used in the Consumer Price Index, that they would have chosen items that have gone up less in price than the average. Yeah, I'm not surprised at that, because items that are produced by large firms tend to be produced more efficiently, and new and better techniques for producing them tend to be discovered, and their prices tend to remain lower. Let me just give you some other facts, which we all know, that don't seem to be true. We talk about the giant multinational corporations. There's a lot of concern about their power and what they're doing to, you know, they're sitting off somewhere in the Azores with their headquarters strangling Portugal, England, the United States, and Venezuela. You know, and the argument that the multinational corporations have governments by the throat, that they're super sovereigns or something. That is so absurd. I don't know what to do. The multinational corporations are scared to death. They are subject to the whims and caprices of the governments of every country in which they operate. The bribe, the whole bribe thing, has been, I think, interestingly, taken by people as evidence of the power of multinational corporations. But it seems to me that when someone pays a bribe, that's evidence of the power of the person to whom he's paying the bribe. But I don't know how you explain. Or OPEC and the oil cartel again. You mentioned, I think I'm going to disagree with something that was implicit in what you said. You talked about keeping those tankers offshore so we can jack up the price. Well, you know, if the oil companies had the power to raise their prices, why did they wait for the Arabs to get their stuff together to do it? It was OPEC that raised oil prices, not the oil companies.
But I was talking about all the old oil. They didn't have to raise prices, but immediately that the act fell, they raised the prices on all the old oil.
Well, I know, because oil was scarce and the price of oil was, people were bidding the price up. You know, let me just ask a question. Suppose you've got a big stock of used cars and new cars continually coming off the production line. All right, now let's suppose we suddenly pass a law. No new cars will be produced. Or all new cars will be sold for $20,000. What's going to happen to the price of used cars the next day? New cars will immediately become more valuable. And that's why the price of old oil went up. You see, rational business firms do not price on the basis of cost. They price on the basis of demand. It doesn't matter what the historical cost of producing it was. That if the demand won't support the cost of producing it, you sell below cost. And if the demand will support far more than the cost of producing it, you sell above cost. And once OPEC countries had closed down that spigot, the price of all oil went up. You know, who cares? I don't care whether I burn old oil or new oil. Oil's oil. We tried through various rationing measures to preserve a price structure that was really designed to prevent the oil companies from reaping windfall profits. But they were windfall profits. I mean, the oil companies that year earned enormous profits. And the enormous profits in the year of the energy crisis were due to this immediate appreciation in the value of the oil company inventories. If you'll notice, if you look at the figures the next year, the profits went right back down again. That was all of a sudden they're holding, of course, the giant oil companies are holding at any time enormous stocks of oil in some stage of production. And when the price of that stuff goes up, they get an enormous increase in their profits because of the appreciation in inventory value. But the whole question, the whole question of the competitiveness of the oil companies, and I want to get through this into something else. So if you don't agree with me, that's okay. I'll let you tell me I'm full of beans later. So what I'm trying to suggest is whichever of us is right is irrelevant. But first, I want to prove that I'm right. Most Americans are convinced that at least the oil companies have to be broken up. That bill almost got through this session of Congress. And I'm just dumbfounded. What makes us think the oil industry is not competitive? The answer is, what makes us think that is the habit of confusing power with size. The oil companies are big, that I'll grant. There are lots of giant oil companies. They're big corporations, but they're also competitive. At every level, the oil business is competitive. The extraction end, until OPEC came in, but notice, that's not a conspiracy of the companies. That's a conspiracy of the countries over which we have no control. Well, maybe we do, but that isn't a matter of antitrust policy. But in the United States, oil production is extremely competitive. There are thousands of oil producers. The oil retailing business, well, everybody knows that's one of the most competitive businesses in the country. How about refining? Scads of refineries. You know, people say, refining is under the control of a few giant oil companies. Then you ask them, name the giant oil companies. And they start naming them, they get up to about 17, and then maybe they realize that that's not a few anymore. And then some people say, well, sure, it's competitive at each level, but this vertical integration thing, you know, that they combine the production and the refining and the retailing, that's what gives them their power. But how? How does it give them their power? Where's the evidence that gives them their power? The only evidence that I've seen is evidence, I put this in quotes, that they've driven independence out of business. But the independence only went out of business because when petroleum products became very, very short in supply, due to the fact that the price was being held down, the companies naturally supplied their own retailers and distributors first, and the independents got squeezed out. But as soon as the price again approached the price that supply and demand would set to clear the market, the independents are coming right back into business. Again, if the oil companies had all this power to strangle us, why is it that the price of gasoline and other petroleum products increased from World War II right up until OPEC turned on the screws at a rate less rapid than the rate of anything else? Think back to what the price of gasoline was 20 years ago and what it was just before the energy crisis. And gasoline had gone up, the average retail price of gasoline in 1955 was 30 cents for regular, just about 30 cents. And in 1972, it was 36 cents. 30 to 36 over a period of 20 years, that's far less than the consumer price index. And the oil companies were not making high profits on investment. They were making large profits, but they were large companies. Large companies are supposed to make large profits. They've got a huge investment. But we hang on to the notion that size is evidence of power. Thus, a lot of people insist that Safeway has them by the throat, not noticing that they can go to Kroger, A&P, Jewel, Piggly Wiggly, Schnucks. I don't know. They're Tom Thumb. Every area has its own. I don't understand it. You know, I just wish sometimes these people who think of the monopolistic power of the grocery chains, I wish they could sit for one afternoon in the seat of the manager of a grocery chain or of one store, and they would get a totally different perspective. These guys know that by cutting, they have to keep their prices down because there are bargain hunters who are watching prices like crazy and who are shifting from one store to another store on the basis of the Thursday ads, and that those 10% of the shoppers, of the big weekend shoppers who are bargain hunters, can be the difference between a profitable weekend and a non-profitable weekend. That's why they give all these coupons. All right, let me make an assertion. You don't have to believe the first part, but you could believe the second part, even if you reject the first part. Economic power is not really much of a problem in the United States today. The problem, which has led us to conclude falsely that there are a group of fat cats somewhere, maybe they're big union chiefs, maybe they're big corporation chiefs, a bunch of people who have us by the throat. The problem is our own sense of impotence. I think it's true. Polls all indicate it. the things I hear from people, things I read in the newspaper indicate that more and more Americans are feeling that they don't have control over their lives. That they're going someplace, things are happening to them that they don't like. And if something is happening to me that I don't like, i.e. I'm impotent, somebody else must be potent. But that doesn't follow. We can all be impotent. And I think that's the danger, that we're all impotent. If that is true, then again, we do not need nearly as much counsel from economists as we suppose. But I think we have a tendency to bring in the economist because the economist is an expert on manageable problems of power, and he can tell us which six corporations to break up so that we feel good again and to regain our freedom. We may break up six corporations, we may do all sorts of other things, but I don't think with any of this we're going to get at the problem.
From whom do you suggest we get counsel?
Well, I think we're going to have to settle the question of why we feel impotent. Do you feel, and when you think about the economy, the society, your place in it, what's happening to your city or to the government or your profession or whatever, do you feel, all right, I think, look at that. Why? What is it that's doing it? I think instead of jumping to the conclusion that there's somebody out there who's got you, ask yourself, what is it you would like to do that you can't do? What is it you want that seems to be forever beyond your grasp? And don't assume that somebody else is holding it and won't let you have it. I think that extensive reorganizations of our patterns of belief and ways in which we interact on community levels are far, far more likely to cure the problem of impotence than any amount of fiscal policy, antitrust legislation, slugging labor unions, or breaking up oil monopolies.
There's one thing, though, that I've been waiting to hear on, and that was the thing that was brought up the other day, and not in your session, but another, is the wealth held by this 0.5% of the country elite. Does this have any effect
okay.
on
that? Okay, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's one thing that I skipped over and I wanted to say something about. I'm not sure I'm going to say what. I'll take your question and address it to my answer. that is the statistics on the way in which wealth is concentrated are often also used by people as evidence that there's somebody in control here. Now, those statistics are often presented in a misleading form. They're presented in a form that ignores the effects of taxes, ignores the effects of income not in money. You know, for example, food stamps, which I don't think you should ignore, and all sorts of government programs designed to put more real income, as distinct from money income, in the hands of relatively poor people. But they also, when we look at the figures, even after we adjust them to make them reflect more realistically the actual distribution of wealth, we ignore the difficulty of further redistributing wealth, and we have, I think, some very, very unrealistic notions about the consequences of wealth redistribution programs. We think that there are a few people way up top who got a big bundle of it, and there's quite a number down at the bottom who don't have anything. It should be easy to take it from them and give it to these. It's not easy. For one thing, you cannot practically give it to those people who are at the bottom without also giving an awful lot to people who are in the middle. Because, for reasons that if you don't understand, I explain it after a while. But you just can't do it. Moreover, if you took it all away from the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Mellons, and the Fords, you wouldn't have a whole lot. Moreover, most of their wealth is not being used to consume goods, but it's really being used for investment purposes. And you wouldn't, if the struggle for a better standard of living is a struggle for consumption goods, we don't want to confiscate capital. But the last point I would mention is this, that when we talk about the redistribution of wealth, and we talk about moving toward equality, most people tend to ignore the most important reason for the inequality of income. Income derives from wealth, but most people's wealth is in the form of human capital. The real important inequities in the distribution of income, or if you don't like the phrase inequities, I'll say the inequalities in the distribution of income that really make a difference and that fry people and that lead to some living plushly and some living in poverty are not due to the fact that some have stocks and bonds, you know, financial assets which they inherited, and others do not. It is primarily due to the fact that some have skills and others do not. Human capital. The most of the inequality in the distribution of income in this country is inequality in wages and salaries. If you compare wages and salaries with property income, you're on the wrong comparison. You've got to look inside the wage and salary distribution. I'm not just thinking of the corporate executive getting $700,000 a year. I'm also thinking of the college professor getting $42,000. And all kinds of professional people and management people. And there are just a lot of people who may, you know, it's weird how many people I know will attack the top 5% and don't know they're in it. I've been astounded at the number of college professors who don't know they're in the top 5% of income receivers.
Paul, how about the power of these? Now, in other words, when you're talking about power in the case of the unions and the government and the corporations, how about the power that these people exert on the things that we need for a necessity of life? In other words, do they manipulate the financial structure so that we, or have they much effect on it so that we are being affected by it or not?
I don't know exactly what you're referring. I don't think there's much manipulation of the financial structure. There's advertising. I'm not convinced of the power of advertising. I happen to think that advertising is generally effective when it tries to persuade people to alter trivial choices. In other words, you're going to smoke. You made that choice. That's a significant choice. Then you say, but now I'm going to smoke True instead of Vantage. I think that's a trivial.
No, I wasn't thinking of that. I was thinking, take Hughes. The Hughes complex.
Yeah.
Did they have any effect on society as far as our wants or needs or so forth? In other words, could they manipulate blocks of money in such a way that it had a huge effect on us any more than the corporation could? Or did they have
I don't. Well, I mean, obviously they can influence little things. If the Hughes financial interest weighs into your community, it can make a huge difference in your community, but I don't think it can affect the economy.
I don't think so. Back to what's the cutoff level for that 5%?
Right now it's about 35,000, I think, for family income.
Family of four?
Okay. For the rich is this? For the
to get in the top 5%.
35,000?
I think it's about that.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen any numbers since later than 73. The data on this are always late because they're very complex gathering process, and the Census Bureau has been botching the collection the last few years. I don't know whether you knew that, but the 1970 census was a bit of a disaster in some areas. I don't know whether they had amateurs on the job or.
Yeah, there's a certain resistance to having the census taken.
And it may have increased, yeah. Well, let's see. It's coffee break time. Al, wait, can I let Al Pitcher say one thing?
I don't think anybody has enough power to do anything significant. I'm not sure. The key issue is what would be significant to do. I don't think anybody in this country, any institution or any simple combination of institutions, has enough power to influence the fundamental ethos of the culture and the values and everything that follows from it. And so you either then go toward a reorganization of a voluntary basis at a small level in communities in the effort to affect the whole meaning structure and the institutions involved in them, or you go to a complete social reorganization on the basis of some ideology and some political movement.
which again, none of us knows how to affect. So even if you wanted to, people say America must go socialist, I regard this as another let's put a bell on the cat thing.
Well, it isn't. I think if you really want to go that way, there are other things to do.
But we don't. Most people don't. Then.
That's right. Yeah. There are enough to do. I mean, there's a growing number. Somehow it's only in this frame of a... It's only when you put the economy under the political, under the politics, and you shift the content of the politics that you're really going to get a viable future.
Assuming that the politics is of high quality.
That's right.
Yeah. By which I don't mean the people in Congress, but the way we talk to one another and think. Well, I don't want to leave you with the impression that economists are totally unimportant people. I've tried to downgrade economic problems, and I've tried to downgrade the ability of economists to solve the problems which are pressing in upon us. And I'm sincere about that. I didn't give an impression other than I wanted to give. I do think economists are important because they can make an important contribution to the maintenance of a smoothly functioning economy. And why is that important? Because the more smoothly the economy functions, the less attention we pay to it. And I think it would be very good if we paid very little attention to the economy. I would like to eliminate various kinds of crises because when they occur, they distract our attention from the questions that I think really need talking about. Economists, again, as Keynes said, are the keepers of the possibility of civilization, but in no sense are they the keepers of civilization.